I was intrigued by a couple of people who became good friends of mine over my seminary years. One was an attorney who had held a position as an elected judge for several years, and the other was a psychiatrist. These two people were leaving behind successful and financially rewarding careers to pursue a future in the ministry with no guarantee of financial security. And they each gave the same reason for changing course. And that reason, in a word, was bioethics. They believed that biotechnology is forcing the human race to confront issues of such importance that every issue, every problem humanity has ever faced will pale in comparison. They further believed that ultimately the impending battles over biotechnology must be fought not on the medical and scientific front, and not even on the legal front, but on the spiritual front. I've wanted to talk about this from the pulpit for a long time, but I've been hesitant. This is a controversial subject. The chance that I will say some things on this subject that will upset some people is 100%. The issues are far too complex to be handled in any one book, let alone in a single sermon or even a series of sermons. But the fact is, I have come to agree with that judge, who is now a Disciples of Christ minister, and that psychiatrist, who is now an Episcopal priest. The subject of bioethics is hands down the most critical subject facing the human race. Bioethics is a subject that makes us uncomfortable. Abortion, genetic engineering, cloning, assisted suicide. I don't have any answers regarding these difficult questions, at least not any answers that I insist you must accept. But I think it is important for each of us to ask ourselves, where does our faith fit into this picture? With these matters of bioethics, we cannot allow the Christian side of the dialogue to be handled by those whom much of society normally calls the Christian voice. A recent Gallup poll revealed that almost one half of Americans believe this statement is true. God created human beings in their present form at one time within the last 10,000 years. Mind you, it's not 50% of Christians who feel that way. It's half the general population. If the question were posed only to churchgoers, the percentage would undoubtedly be much higher. I have never been more fearful about the future of the human race than when I read that statistic. Let me explain why. For those of us who refuse to pretend all of modern science is a lie, and who accept the material world we discover through microscopes and telescopes, we have a very big God. This God has called creation into being over billions and billions of years. This God has built into creation an evolutionary process that brought forth thinking, feeling, loving beings. And it wasn't easy, and it wasn't quick. Each and every one of us is a miracle, the product of billions of years of effort on the part of God and God's universe. For those who think that with a snap of God's fingers, poof, human beings appeared, well, are we really that important? I mean, if God took 1 second of time and human beings instantly sprang into existence, then God could do it again, right? What's the big deal if we kill ourselves off or genetically tinker the human race out of existence? So what? With one snap of God's fingers, Earth will be restored to a pristine state, and in another instant, the Earth can be repopulated with more human beings. No. The fact that it took God billions of years to bring forth creatures who can think and feel and love one another doesn't make God any less powerful. It makes God even more awesome, more amazing, and it makes human beings more important. And for any discussion we have regarding bioethics, we need to establish that as an absolute standard. Human beings are important. We are not God's one-day test tube experiment. We are the long-term products of God's infinite wisdom and unfathomable love. With that as a premise, I will proceed in this manner. Today, we will examine the issue of abortion. Next week, we will deal with genetic engineering. I approach these subjects cautiously because I know emotions run high with regard to these matters. I'm aware that it is impossible to say anything about this subject without offending somebody. My hope is that everybody will keep in mind throughout this discussion that I am not telling you how you should think about these matters. I will simply tell you where I am in my faith journey, suspecting that many of you may be as pained and confused as I am with regard to these matters. Abortion. Two comments regarding my words on this subject. First, I will use the terms pro-life and pro-choice, since those are the terms most commonly used in this debate. I don't like those terms, but I'll stick with them this morning. Second, we could talk all day about where the line should be drawn regarding abortion, at what point in the development of the fetus it becomes a viable human being. Few pro-choice advocates believe a woman should be able to obtain an abortion just days before she is scheduled to give birth to a healthy child. For this discussion, we'll draw the line at conception, defining pro-life as the view that life begins at conception and deserves legal protection from the moment of conception. As you are all aware, this is the 10-year anniversary of the Summer of Mercy, in which pro-life factions from across the country targeted Wichita. Back then, in 1991, federal marshals had to be called in, and 2,700 people were arrested. This week begins what will be at least a week-long renewal of the Summer of Mercy. Once again, abortion protesters and defenders from around the nation have descended on Wichita. Honestly, there is no issue over which I have spent more time in prayer than the issue of abortion. I have asked myself time and again where Jesus would be with regard to this issue. My two seminary friends, the judge and the psychiatrist, after much prayer, one wound up pro-choice and one pro-life. I will tell you that if Jesus were to somehow appear in Wichita this week, I do not believe he would be on either side of the picket line, which will be set up at our local clinic. I believe he would be gentle and understanding of all people on both sides of the issue, and I believe he would and does love the people on both sides of the issue. I find myself envious of people on both sides of this debate because each side seems so sure of itself. Many of those who call themselves pro-life and who call themselves pro-choice seem to have no doubts whatsoever they are on the right side of the argument. I don't normally talk about the subject because I've discovered I manage to upset people on both sides of the debate. And when people ask me whether I am pro-life or pro-choice, I give them a most unsatisfying answer. I am neither. Let me explain why I don't like either of those labels applied to me. Whatever those words may have meant at one time, I do not believe either phrase now represents, for me, an acceptable moral position. I began by saying that we, as people of faith, need to have a voice in this discussion. I do not believe that either side of this issue can make a strong claim to representing a faithful approach to the issue of abortion, because in my opinion, the words pro-life and pro-choice do not represent religious or moral values. They represent political views. And there's nothing wrong with that. People are entitled to their political views. But let's call a spade a spade. Whatever the original motivations behind those movements, they are for the most part today political movements. And as I see the issue of abortion, there are actually five groups at work here. There's two groups of pro-life people, and there's two groups of pro-choice people, and there's a fifth group, of which I am a part, who dangle in the limbo between those other groups, caught in the crossfire, and praying for the right answer. Let's examine each group. First, there's the pro-life faction, which, as I said, is actually composed of two subgroups. Pro-life. That sounds so good. I mean, how do you answer a question like, are you pro-life? Of course, we're all pro-life, aren't we? What's the alternative? Pro-death? No doubt about it. This faction wins the battle of titles in the abortion debate. But I can't possibly discuss this group without drawing a line between its two subgroups, which I'll call the compassionate pro-lifers and the radical pro-lifers. I have a great deal of respect for the compassionate pro-lifers. I know a lot of people who fall into this group. They believe with heart and soul that human life is sacred and human life begins at conception. The horrific number of abortions that take place in our society drive these people to their knees in anguish. And they do more than talk the talk. They walk the walk. They support programs that provide assistance to poor families after they have children for whom they did not plan and cannot afford. And after counseling young pregnant women to see their pregnancies through to full term, they adopt some of those otherwise unwanted children. For those who feel this strongly and who approach this issue not with empty and self-righteous rhetoric, but with real conviction, putting their hearts, their lives, and their pocketbooks on the line for what they believe, I have the deepest and most abiding respect. I have more difficulty having compassion for the more belligerent faction of pro-lifers, the radical pro-lifers. It seems to me that many of these people want to punish young women for getting pregnant. You've been naughty. Now you have to pay the consequences. I come to this conclusion because of the way some in this faction, a minority, seem to lose all love for the child once it exits the womb. I don't understand how it is that some people in the pro-life faction seem so concerned with fetal tissue and so unconcerned with living, breathing babies. They protest outside clinics. They denigrate women in crisis who seek abortions, trying to convince us that life is so precious, so holy, it must be preserved at all cost. And I respect their right to believe that. But how often do they vote for legislators who fight against easily available contraceptives and cut programs to feed and care for those unwanted children once they enter the world? Again, please recognize I'm drawing a distinct line between those who walk the walk and those who merely talk the talk. For one group, it's a moral issue, and for the other, it's a strictly political issue. And one group brings prayerful hope to the situation, while the other brings anger and violence. The pro-life group Operation Save America has spent much of the past 2 months in Wichita organizing. These words come from their website, which they have used over the past months to draw people to Wichita for this week's events. I quote, "We've allowed the blood of innocent children to flow through the streets of this city, and be certain, bloodshed follows bloodshed, violence follows violence. There can be no more compromise, no more common ground. It's time to lay down our lives for others." That sounds to me like a call to violence. I do not think that reflects the feelings of the vast majority of pro-life people, of compassionate pro-lifers. And I pray with all my heart that the voice of peace prevails within the pro-life group. I think this militant branch of the movement may have revealed its true agenda when it listed the churches here in town to be boycotted. Ours wasn't originally on that list, by the way, and it listed my friend George Gardner's church, College Hill United Methodist, because of his pro-choice activism, and it listed Reformation Lutheran, because that's the church attended by George Tiller, who operates the local clinic that performs abortions. But it also listed a church pastored by a close friend of mine, Pastor Shelley Hamilton, of First Metropolitan Community Church. This is the local church that provides a very important ministry to the gay and lesbian community. First Metropolitan is almost exclusively gay and lesbian. For obvious reasons, they don't have a big problem with abortion. But Operation Save America will be protesting in front of Shelley's church over the next few weeks. And that tells me that some of the people who will be protesting this week are driven not so much by the prayerful respect for human life as by a broad political agenda supported by the religious right. As for the pro-choice crowd, well, I once again have to think of this group as having two subgroups. First, there are the people who have prayerfully struggled with this issue and come to the conclusion, while they detest the idea of abortion, they simply cannot seek laws that would impose their moral values on other people. In our own religious tradition of congregationalism, there's always been an emphasis on individual responsibility and the rights of individuals to hold differing opinions. Congregationalists have traditionally believed that people are responsible to God for the choices they make, that their choices are between them and God, and it's not the right of a person in the pews, nor even of a congregational minister, to stand between any other person and their God. Many in this group are affected by the knowledge that women with crisis pregnancies still sought abortions by some estimate of the rate of over 1 million per year, even when they were illegal. And thousands of those women died. That fact, combined with a reluctance to impose their moral values on others, leads these people to prayerfully believe abortion should remain legal. Obviously, I respect those who fall into this category. At the same time, there is what I would call a radical pro-choice faction. For these people, what began as the right of a woman to control her own body has turned into a political movement which holds abortion to be an acceptable and easy method of birth control. Abortion, hey, that's no big deal, right? What have I got to do today? Let's see, go to the store, shampoo the carpet, run by and get an abortion, wash the car. My point is, this is serious. Human life is serious. And the fact is, we are dealing with a potential human life here. Having an abortion should require a little more thought than clipping our toenails. As for me, I find this to be one of the most trying issues I've ever wrestled with. I'm in that fifth group I talked about earlier. The answer, in my eyes, is to simply make unwanted pregnancies a thing of the past. One thing I wish we could do as a society is to stop glamorizing recreational sex. We should boycott the movies and turn off the television programs that portray men and women, boys and girls, casually hopping from bed to bed with no consequences. And we need to teach our children that abstaining from sex is the right thing to do, and that entering into a sexual relationship makes life much more complicated. But this is not a fantasy world, and I am a realist. Human beings are sexually driven creatures, and not every human being has found a lifetime partner. There are very effective methods of contraception. I would like to see the day when pregnancies arise only from committed, loving relationships. I hope the day soon comes when a woman who finds herself with an unwanted pregnancy doesn't feel shame or guilt so much as a sense of absolute stupidity. Instead of others saying, "Shame on you," they should be saying, "How could that possibly have happened?" On that day, women will truly have control of their own bodies, and we will have eliminated abortion the right way, through a lack of need. I pray for the day when the news of every conception is received with joy, and when every child enters this world both wanted and loved. In the meantime, what do we do? What is the answer? I mean, ultimately, a person has to get on one side or the other. I certainly hope people avoid getting into the radical groups on either side of this issue. But the bottom line, the final question, as I understand it, is this. Should I support the enactment of laws that forbid a woman to have an abortion? I can only tell you where I am at this point in my faith journey, hoping you will respect my right to my position, knowing that I certainly respect your right to hold yours. Look at the question again. should I support the enactment of laws that forbid a woman to have an abortion? As a 46-year-old man who knows he will never himself have a crisis pregnancy, I cannot do that. As a person of faith who believes that each and every human being is a free and responsible moral agent before God, I cannot do that. As a congregational minister, I cannot do that. Aside from pregnancies where the mother's life is in danger or where she is the victim of rape, I doubt if I could ever counsel a woman to get an abortion as a means of birth control. I don't know. I've never been confronted with that situation. I'm sure I would advise her to take her thoughts to God in prayer in consultation with her family, her physician, and her faith community. But who am I, really, to make that decision for her? I hope every woman who is faced with such a decision makes her decision with prayerful consideration. I'm sure we all pray for the day when abortions are just a thing of the past, when every conception is the result of a loving relationship, and when every child arrives in this world wanted and loved. Until then, my belief is that abortion should be rare, but safe and legal. For that reason, I belong to a group of laity and clergy known as Kansas Religious Leaders for Choice. Most of us detest abortion, but we are united in the conviction that it is not our place to make moral decisions for a woman in crisis. I hope all of you will pray for peace in the days ahead. Really, there aren't a lot of bad guys in this situation. Even the radicals on both sides believe in what they are doing, and you have to respect that. And if you're like me, painfully and prayerfully caught in the middle, look for Jesus in this situation. I think I was wrong when I said Jesus would not be found among the protesters at the local clinic. He will be there in men and women on both sides of the picket line, and he will be easy enough to spot. He's not the one holding up shocking pictures, and he's not the one shouting obscenities at those who do. He, she, is the one standing quietly and shedding tears.